What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today the rivers of spice will soon run with water. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we will be covering the second half of chapter 34, and this is the 41st episode. Yes, we actually looked it up this time. So, so we're starting out the 40s with a rather intriguing chapter, but before that, I'm sure y'all's lives are more intriguing. So is there anything that's interesting that you may want to update us on?
I went ice skating yesterday.
Whoa, did you break anything? Fall?
No, but I have some just some slight friction burns, I guess, on my ankle or something.
Oh.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Let me get that when you ice skate.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible to get out of ice skating without an injury.
I actually need to ask an ice skater in my school, how do they not have permanent burns on their legs from that?
Just get good, bro.
Just get good.
I think the last time I ice skated was in 7th grade.
Yeah.
I think you were there, Humphrey.
I don't actually remember the last time I ice skated.
7th grade?
Yeah, well, maybe, but honestly, I don't even remember. I feel like last time I went was maybe with my parents, but...
Oh,
but I'm not sure. Yeah, we should go ice skating sometime.
Yeah,
after crazy college applications, right?
Speaking of college applications, I submitted my first one yesterday.
Hey, I just submitted one today, so we're all getting them in. You know.
Yep.
Cram them by the weekend.
Yeah.
Well, this weekend.
Yeah, honestly, the only time I have to actually work on applications is the weekend. So, also record the podcast. Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool. Sure. Alrighty. So, without further ado, Nolan, you can take it away with the epigraph.
Actually, we don't have an epigraph today because we're right in the middle of the chapter.
Indeed.
But let's go on to the quotes.
Yeah.
For Fillmore.
Okay. My quotes this week, I chose, "This was a dream to capture men's souls, and she could sense the hand of the ecologist in it. This was a dream for which men would die willingly. It was another of the essential ingredients that she felt her son needed. People with a goal. Such people would be easy to imbue with fervor and fanaticism. They could be wielded like a sword to win back Paul's place for him."
Cool.
Wow. He's a chef now.
Yeah, he's manipulating everything, indeed. Yeah, so my quote was, "To Paul, the sound was like moments ticking away. He could feel time flowing through him, the instants never to be recaptured. He sensed the need for decision, but felt powerless to move."
Mm.
Yeah, he's paralyzed.
Roasted.
Yeah,
not a good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah, my quote is, "There were those among us in need of water," he said, "yet they will come here and not touch this water. Do you know that?"
Among us.
Oh no! Yeah. Everywhere I go, I see his face.
Yep.
Okay.
Anyways.
Let's get into the chapter.
Yep.
And we start off actually this episode by firstly catching kind of a glimpse of a form of currency inside the Fremen world. And I'm kind of unsure if this is only very specific to water only, or they use currency for other things like trading for spies or necessities. But at least for water, the Fremen have different sized rings to represent liters of water. And then they have what they call water counts for the drachms of water. So, in a way, the way that they have it in the way that they loop stuff through it, it reminds me of the ancient Chinese coinage where it's a circle and has a square hole in the middle. And also, supposedly, they also use threads, they threaded string through it to sort and carry them around with them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another indication that water is the most valuable currency, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder what the direct correlation is, though. Is a bottle of water $1,000 or... I don't know.
I mean, I guess dollars isn't a good measure since it's,
I feel like it's based on how much water. I feel like the currency itself is based on how much water you're getting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So it's not just a commodity. It's an actual, these coins are not the gold standard, but the water standard,
Yeah, the water standard.
Yeah, something
like that. Imagine water cryptocurrencies, liquid coin.
Oh, no.
On Earth?
Yeah, well, on Earth, that'd be pretty worthless, but. Yeah. Anyways, so it's funny because Paul accidentally just courts Chani, so he's just pulling without actually knowing it, right? And it's
what a player,
honestly. Yeah, but still doesn't match up to Nolan. I mean,
Yeah, whoa. He definitely reminded me of a certain someone.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's really interesting how Paul does it, because he offers, you know, these water counter, you know, that count the drachms. He offers them to Shani, and Shani's like really surprised, you know. And so Paul doesn't realize that, you know, offering water counters to a woman is just the same as, you know, maybe offering money or, you know, courting or something like that. And
they call it dowry or something.
I'm not
dowry?
Sure.
Dowry.
Dowry. Yeah. Dowry. Well, that's actually for wedding, I think. Like, it's like a wedding gift. Yeah. But I don't think it's necessarily probably just some elaborate form of dating. Yeah. But but notice how Stilgar says, you know, this is without commitment, and commitment kind of implies marriage. So that must mean offering water is pretty high up on the things you can do to attract, you know, a certain somebody, right? So It's not just something simple like helping hold her bag or, you know, picking up her books or something. It's not anything like that. It's an actual, like, serious thing. So Paul accidentally, you know, does this, and it's kind of funny. Yeah.
It's kind of like giving her the ring or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, like, because he basically did offer her the rings that she was giving. Like, she gave him some rings and he gave it back to her. So I was like, whoa, let's go put it on her finger.
Yeah. Honestly. Oh, yeah, that is true. Yeah. It's like offering a ring. Yeah.
So we see some of Jessica's thoughts in this entire process, and she's not too pleased with, like, the whole Chani thing. But we also see that she's also quite on edge from something else. We see that, like, despite everything going basically as well as it could go, that even the tribe overlooking, like, little, like, Paul's little accident with Chani, Jessica still fears the wild violence that could explode out of these seemingly simple moments. And then, like, I don't really understand, but maybe I'm wrong, but I think Jessica's honestly just misreading the Fremen. Like, yeah, maybe it's like still a fragile, vulnerable moment for the Fremen that they're sharing with these outsiders. But I feel as long as Jessica and Paul don't intentionally, like, provoke the Fremen, or, like, intentionally screw up, they'll be forgiven as, like, there's minor slip-ups, you know? Like, they're not, like, they're not, like, trying to hurt the Fremen.
Yeah, it's really interesting how Jessica mentions that this seems like a child's game in adult hands, right? And, I mean, I don't see how this resembles a game, because we see that, you know, Jan, Jan, Jan from the last chapter means go, 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 but it seems like a rather sophisticated death ritual than, you know, a child play. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Perhaps when they say it was, like, a child's game that had lost all inhibition in adult hands, I kind of think of it as similar to how little children play games of war when they're little.
Oh.
And in the hands of adults, this game of war becomes real.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
So I guess an example with this is, have you guys watched Squid Game?
I know I have not watched it, but I know the plot. Yeah.
I've seen a lot.
Spoiler alert, in the final scene, they play Squid Game. Wow.
Wow.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Except it's much more violent. So the fight between the last two people it's actually quite similar to the knife fight between Paul and Jamis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean,
so in the hands of adults, it makes things way more worse.
Yeah, it's, you know, you go from playing with wooden sticks to playing with knives and then playing with guns, right? So
they're playing with
they're playing with nukes, and then America. It's just, as you grow up, you know, you get your hands on big boy things, but not everyone should get their hands on big boy things. Yeah, so I see. Yeah, really,
they
really
stay good. Safe.
Yeah.
So some form of technology that we get in this chapter is that we get something pretty cool. Herbert kind of reveals that the Fremen kind of has their own secret way of gathering water out of their environment. So it's described as, like, they capture moisture from the desert air through, like, a system of what they call honeycomb lattices, which to me are basically just, like, what, a net or something, or like a water filter. So I kind of remember seeing something like this featured on CNN 10 in 7th grade.
Oh.
And it was like this fog nets made of nanofiber that's used in arid, like, developing regions of the world to harvest drinkable water from the moisture-laden air, especially, like, on mountains, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, to be honest, the earliest mentions I looked on the internet was that I could find this technology kind of went back to, like, 2017, maybe.
Wow.
I'm just, like, really happy that Herbert had this, like, already envisioned back in the 60s, because, like, it just seems really cool. Like, I wish he was alive to see, like,
his ideas come to fruition.
Yeah, like, his idea, like, actually become real. Like, I'm not sure how much inspiration that drew from Herbert, or, like, if that's just something that humans have always thought about, but it just seems super cool for Herbert to, like,
definitely.
I don't know how to happen.
Yeah, and I find that, you know, this is really interesting, because I thought that the dune atmosphere is always pretty arid. There's not, you know, a lot of moisture, but somehow there's enough moisture to satisfy the Fremen and actually be able to collect it so that it's a reasonable amount, right? So, I mean,
yeah,
you're right. This is another example of Herbert somewhat, you know, predicting the future. Right?
He might be an actual prophet. Like, but I was wondering that
he is the Messiah.
He's the next Nostradamus.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if this main source of main or getting water is their main source of it, because I honestly expected there to be some sort of water in the caves as well, because caves are tend to be damp and like
Yeah, they collect
they're made
water.
from yeah.
Yeah.
But I
I'm not
guess
sure if
not.
it's like their, I don't think it's their main source because like I feel like this is a recently developed technology even in Doom World, so like I feel like there was a source of water before then that they relied on before they came to this
Maybe, but then
conclusion.
how did they come up with such a large mat like storage of water without having had this thing running for generations? I don't know. It's like you that's one thing, but the other thing is, why would they have collected water if Kynes wasn't there? And Kynes we know hasn't been alive for way too long, right?
Yeah, he's
So
old man.
wasn't he around 60, 50?
Maybe, yeah, maybe he wasn't that old,
He's
definitely.
a
He wasn't that
decade.
old.
Yeah, he's somewhere
Yeah,
in this
a few
decade.
decades. Yeah,
He was middle aged.
I mean, in this case, the, like 50 years, 100 years. Like, how did they got so much water, right? And
Yeah.
so I
And
don't know.
also, Kynes was on spice, meaning that his life was extended.
True.
That's
Yeah.
true.
So I mean, like we can assume maybe 100 years or so, right? But
Yeah.
at most, and definitely just 100 years of collecting the water though is might not be enough. I feel. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe, but
Yeah.
the other thing is, Kynes probably had generations of, like his father and other stuff, generations before him, maybe. Yeah.
I don't
Not sure about
know.
that one.
Yeah, we'll talk about a bit later as we talk about something related to kinds, especially about the dream. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll save that for later. Yep.
So for right now, let's just like someone should explain to me what like this whole race consciousness that like Paul is speaking about, because like in a world where every minuscule choice of Paul's should definitely create ballooning effects in the future, how can Paul be sure that like the violent jihad that he fears is so unavoidable, right? Because like I don't understand, like before he was thinking that like every single move I make will like mess up the fight with Jameis, right? So I shouldn't think too hard on it. And now he's just like, oh no, it's unavoidable the future, even though he's making like all these minor like details that's not part of his plan. And then like this race consciousness is like supposedly informing him that it's impossible. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think this race consciousness is probably just some primal desire or some primal. I just always it reminds me of like Jung's like collective unconscious, that theory. I mean, even though I kind of forgot all of my psychology, but I mean, in this case, there were it's the ideas or thoughts shared by members of a race or humans, right? So I'm not sure though why this jihad relates to the entire human race, because all for what I know, definitely Paul is not out there with the Atreides recruiting the entire human race, right? But I suppose that it's a primal desire potentially for all humans to go down this violent jihad path, kind of just let go of your inhibitions and just join this frenzy, the mob,
The mob rule.
mob rules sort of. So it's also unclear how everyone dying here connects to, avoidance of the jihad, as you said. So there's not a lot of rhyme or reason, I feel like.
Yeah, I also don't quite understand why he refers to it as race, unless the Atreides are their own race, which doesn't exactly make sense. So when he says or when he refers to race, I think it's just relating to the Fremen race, actually, and how he uses them for his terrible purpose.
Maybe.
I don't know if the Fremen can count as another race, though. Like, if
I
it's
don't
just
see them
race.
as entirely different. I see them just like adapted to the desert, you know?
I guess,
I
but.
mean, I suppose if you think about it, but depends on how long the Fremen have been around. But from what we know, they've been around for quite a while, right? So.
Yes. They could still interbreed with kinds, meaning that they're still within the same species.
Yeah.
No. No,
So.
but humans have multiple species, though. There's multiple species within humans.
Oh, really? I thought we were all just Homo sapiens.
We're the last. We're the only ones that survived till this day.
Yeah, like
Yeah.
Homo sapiens, right?
I guess that's
Homo
true.
sapiens, yeah.
But there used to be. There
Huh.
used to be other ones, and then
Perhaps.
they
I mean,
died.
I don't know. Yeah, definitely we're genetically close enough to breed, right? But
It's probably not going to happen.
Disturbing thoughts, guys.
Yeah, well, no. I think the Fremen are definitely human.
I think they're
Yeah,
human, yeah.
but maybe yeah, maybe Herbert is, you're right. Maybe Herbert is referring it to it in the context of the Fremen. I think that makes the most sense. Somehow the Fremen and we also get to this later, with Nolan's quote and everything, but yeah, the Fremen might have, some different styles of thinking that make them more susceptible to stuff like this.
Yeah, I just think back on like how Jessica, when she first met them, was super impressed by their militaristic structure. So I kind of think of them as kind of like slightly warlike tribe type of people. It's kind of probably the wrong way to think about them, but I can't help it with the description that Jessica gave. So here we actually get to something about this glowing flow meter within the shiny cave of water. And it's actually kind of weird because it's glowing and then there's like this moving pointer, and then that's not the only part. That it doesn't actually hold any moisture once it goes, like once you pour the water, it just like loses all the moisture, like it flows all the way down. Which I don't really understand like how that's supposed to be like scientifically explained in the Dune world. Cause like even in our world, we haven't achieved something that like that precise, accurate. I don't know. Cause like we pour water and we measure it through like reading the ticks, like the bars, and be like, oh, that's like 3 liters, right? But the only thing I could think of closest to this is like the coin counters, because we pour coins in, they count it through what falls through and the size that falls through. But we just haven't reached that stage with liquids yet. Like our liquids, we can't read the volume of liquids just by it flowing through this little hole. Like, I don't understand.
Well, I think, I mean, there is technology actually invented, so I did like some Googling, and so basically Googling flow meter, it's probably just some measure of the volumetric flow rate at a specific point on the pipe. So, quick physics lesson. I had to do a little research. I don't remember physics well, but if you basically take the cross-sectional area of the pipe, which is like the radius times the yeah, and then you take the radius times radius squared times pi, right? So the cross-sectional area, and you multiply by the velocity that the water is traveling through, you can obtain, this is called the volumetric flow rate, basically like the rate at which like the volume of water is moving across like some certain distance in the pipe. And if you also know the time that takes the water to pass through the pipe, and you can multiply the rate with the time to get the volume. So there's,
That's really
yeah,
cool.
so it, of course I doubt we have anything that accurate, right? Because one drachm is already like pretty small, and then you get 330 seconds, but and there's bound to be a lot of error, right? And honestly, I don't even know if my math is fully correct, because I really honestly forgot my concepts behind, fluid mechanics and whatever, but that's just a kind of general idea. Well, hopefully I didn't lose too many listeners with that, right? But it's also fascinating that the flow meters have this coating. I feel like it's a coating, I don't know, or maybe some material that resists this adhesive quality of water, doesn't let it, stick to the sides of a pipe. So I thought that was really
I think it's a
interesting too.
coating.
Oh, so it's like a hydrophobic material.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So it, resists these hydrogen bonds that are being formed with the sides of the, sides of the pipe, I guess, and the actual water itself.
Okay, so basically, to recap what you said, so if you find how fast the water is moving in like a certain area, you can figure out how much water passed by using the time, right? Okay, so I dumbed it down for the listeners. You're
Not saying the
welcome.
listeners are dumb, it's just we understand that not everyone likes physics, and I definitely don't like physics. I did not enjoy having to go back to physics memories to make this
As a
section, but
future
I think it's
Me too.
it's, yeah, as a
Physics
future engineer, yeah, I think
not it. Physics not
not my
it.
thing. I will not become a physicist. Anyways, yeah, so yeah, hopefully didn't lose too many people, but all right, now we're back to the real material. So they have 380 million liters of water here.
Whoa.
So or 38 million deciliters, 380 million liters of water. So that is a large number, and it's incredible in and of itself, right? I don't know of a physical man-made storage of water that contains that much. However, the Hoover Dam, in comparison, contains about 36 trillion liters of water, apparently. So it basically nullifies the already large number of 380 million. What, 36 trillion
That's
is
crazy.
maybe a million times larger than maybe a million Hoover dams worth. I mean, a million Fremen storage worth will contribute to a Hoover dam, right? So that's,
That's not enough. I like,
yeah.
I
And
don't know. I'm
think about how
sorry.
little ma like land mass the Hoover Dam covers for a planet like
Not for the
Earth.
whole planet.
Yeah, and they remember they need 4% of the planet to be,
Well, I thought it was 3%.
or maybe something like that, and to be recarbonating and stuff. Yeah, like the carbon cycle. So yeah, I mean, it gives hope, but there's a massive but there, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they're gonna need, I have to need at least like not 1 million, but 1 billion times the amount they have now in order to reach Kynes's goal. But I mean, it's kind of, it looks like they're well on their way, because Stilgar mentions that they have thousands of places like this, meaning that they already
True.
have billions of liters of water. Although I'm still not sure if that's enough to put Kynes' dream into fruition.
Yeah, it's crazy how much water you need. Just imagine like a whole planet. Yeah,
but also like right now we are attempting to like control the weather in some areas, and it's not going as planned. Like we know how it's supposed to work. Like we put particles in the air and hoping to catch moisture, but it still doesn't always work.
Right. I remember actually reading an article about some you know thing to put silver nitrate into clouds or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe it was silver.
Yeah,
nitrate.
I think they did that in Dubai.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I know China does heavy tests on it as well.
Yeah.
So
but you know it's basically they tried to run experiments where they would put like silver nitrate particles or something like that into the clouds. And then nothing statistically significant came out of it. So,
yeah, like even like Kynes' dream, like it's possible, but at the same time, they're probably gonna need a lot more water to experiments on it first.
Right. Yeah, they
honestly though, I'm not quite sure how ethical it is to mess with the weather, because usually countries that are supposed to get the rain won't get the rain because the water is moved elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, basically, ethics or not.
Time to go study my daily dose of meteorology.
We're delving into different subjects every single day.
This episode's so much science. But it's fun. I'll enjoy discussing science. That's why I'm going into science. Right, but it's also interesting, I feel, that they have to protect the water from the little makers, from the worms, by walling it off. And you know there must be some large feats of construction to actually physically store this much water in a dig through proof case, impenetrable case, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a feat in itself finding material strong enough to keep the worms away. Like,
right.
Keep in mind, some of these worms are a quarter of a mile long or around 400 meters.
Well, they did say these are for the little makers. Maybe the big makers can't actually dig this deep.
Yeah, but I thought that like the makers actually can't penetrate rock. So if they just made it into like a rock thing, like a cavern. I mean, a cavern is basically a rock thing. So like,
really?
They can't bite through a rock. Like that's why they run onto the shelves. You know, like the rock shelves.
All I know is that I forgot what. I can't remember what animal was.
No, they can definitely bite through stuff, material stronger than rock. They just can't. I guess they just can't swallow.
They can't
something
do
that's
it.
Bigger than their mouth.
Yeah.
All I know is, you know, there's, I don't know if it's earthworms or something, but you put them in the ground and then they, you know, break up all the hard stuff and they turn it into fertile soil. I don't know about anything about that. I don't really remember. But if these are worms, you know, then theoretically they should be able to break through the rock.
I don't know
how strong these little makers are, right? Maybe they're just.
You also don't know how intelligent they are.
Mm-hmm.
Intelligence plays a key role in this, because you don't need strength if you can figure out another way.
Yeah, maybe there's some other way to keep the worms away, right? So, I mean, but that's really interesting. But it's also crazy how accurate they are in their measurements, because they know within 10 million liters how much water they need to start. That carbon cycle to get the face of a rock is to turn green. Like within 10 million liters, you know, just imagine they need a Hoover's Dam's worth of water, like 38 trillion liters, and they know that to within 10 million. That's, you know, really impressive.
Not
that's
bad.
Within one millionth, basically, accuracy.
Yeah.
That's really crazy.
I wonder who did the calculations for that, though. I'm assuming it's Kynes, but how did he figure that out?
That is really crazy. I don't know if it's Kynes, but if it is him, you know, he has some crazy math skills.
The Fremont Isaac Newton, who doesn't need a calculator, is coming out here.
He's got the brain of a mentor.
He's got. One day he was sitting under a sand cliff and some water fell on his head. You know, he had a sudden inspiration. Yeah, sounds familiar, huh? Yeah.
Okay, so now we finally get to my quote of the week. We get, "There were those among us in need of water," he said. "Yet they will come here and not touch this water. Do you know that?" So this quote is actually from Stilgar, and I really think this quote truly displays the will of the Fremen. In a way, kind of like the Fremen have stooped really low to the point that like they're considered uncivilized by some, and they like replicate the ways of desert animals, so they're like animalistic, right? Mm-hmm. So they barely like scrape by surviving the ways of the desert, and they're considered basically like wild beasts or like wild like pests of the desert by many in society, even like the Atreides, even like the Bene Gesserit, and even like the Harkonnens, of course. However, like in spite of like the entire universe kind of viewing them in this negative light, I still kind of find them to kind of like have their own aspect of humanity to it, because they have absolute control over themselves, which has been instilled into them ever since they were born, because they have to survive that way. But the thing is, their discipline is second to none. Like, their resolve is unwavering, especially in collecting all this water and, like, not giving it away. Because, like, there's, like, people are dying and, like, they're not willing to give even, like, the tiniest portion of it. So, in many ways, the Fremen are, like, the most human in a way that they can resist their emotions and, like, the need to, like, have their body react due to, like, instinct or something. So, like, I find that, like, the whole Gom-Jabbar test, like, this entire, like, life or death situation that the Fremen live in kind of replicates that. And just shows that they do have the humanity that it takes to survive even the direst, most painful circumstances. So they just embody humanity to me.
Yeah, I really like that analysis. The Fremen are an enigma, and they're kind of a contradiction in of themselves if we use the Bene Gesserit definitions of humanity, but also they kind of align with the definitions of humanity that the BG have, because their self-control and this, response of Bilal Khalifa, it kind of seems sort of like a cult-like devotion to the cause. And if they're a cult, then they kind of revert to more primitive, instincts. So though they have the self-control, it may be to their detriment sometimes.
It's like
But I think this is what separates them from the Sardaukar and makes them more superior, because their talent is natural, not artificial.
Damn.
The Sardaukar, they were forced into harsh conditions, not of their own volition, while the Fremen have always naturally been on Arrakis. And we know in terms of harshness, Arrakis is probably worse than Yeti Prime, right? Isn't that where they're from? Yeah. So when it comes down to talent and hard work versus just pure hard work, I hate to say it, but talent usually triumphs.
Yeah, definitely. I
Yeah,
agree.
when you have the same amount of time to develop it, talent's always going to come out on top. You have to put in more
Exactly.
time
Well,
if you want to catch up.
because they already start, from somewhere, not just from nowhere. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and actually, regarding the Bilal Kaifa, I did a quick Google search on it, and it seems that it comes from an Arabic phrase, Bilal Kaif, and roughly translates to without asking how or without knowing how or what, which is basically unwavering devotion to the cause, and this cause is, like restoring the planet.
Yeah, I mean, even without Googling, I guess there's some reverence and respect behind the words. It's kind of momentous. So in the context of the way the Fremen say it, it kind of is a clear, like,
Yeah, they do mention religious ritual behind the word.
Oh yeah, I do remember that. Yeah, I think Jessica said that, right? So
I think so.
yeah. Yeah, so we get to my quote for the week. So I'll read it again. To Paul, the sound was like moments ticking away. He could feel time flowing through him, the instants never to be recaptured. He sensed the need for a decision, but felt powerless to move. Yeah, so I picked this because I can relate to Paul's predicament here, and many times personally, I've kind of felt that a specific decision is just so tough to make, and not on his scale, but in my personal life, and so much kind of relies on that decision, and the pressure and the silence kind of build to a breaking point, I feel like. But you really still can't make a decision. The time just ticks by, and time slows down, and everyone's waiting on you, but you can't just tilt one way or the other, right? And Paul, especially with his future seeing abilities, I feel must have the hardest decisions of all, because he can calculate all of the lines and possibilities, right, and potentially negative paths that are associated with his choices. I mean, I could just make a random decision and just cross my fingers, and if it doesn't work out, I'll just look back on it and just be like, dang, that didn't work out. But yeah, I mean, but Paul can't even do that because he can see everything, and he's weighing worse against worser against worser, right? So that must not really be a fun experience at all.
But on the upside, at least he'll be good at gambling.
Oh well,
Kind of.
yeah. Honestly, he should just go to the Vegas of this world and just gamble enough money for the Fremen to buy a ton of water.
Yeah. Save the planet, the gambling.
He could just gamble. He'd probably get kicked out of the casino, honestly. They think he's
Honestly,
cheating.
though. Card counter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but that's
Yeah.
honestly just having that sense of almost omnipotence. It's just, it's kind of too much for one person to handle, especially when every single decision they make, it's especially the decision that they personally make, is going to affect all the paths. It it'll lead them to a path of destruction or a path of relief. I'm not just like
Oh no. But I
whatever.
mean, it's a human brain trying to comprehend this massive data set, right?
Right.
And it's a constantly fluctuating data set. You can't even sit down and process it. So that's, that it's
Hurts.
not what the brain is built for. And of course Paul's built different, but
Of
yeah, it's not
course.
built that different. Yeah.
It's not that special.
Wow. Guess you're just downplaying my boy Paul.
Yeah. Are you questioning his Kwasa Todorok status?
Yeah.
Okay. Disbeliever.
Okay, so moving on to my quote, I'm going to recap it real quick. It goes, "This was a dream to capture men's souls, and she could sense the hand of the ecologist in it. This was a dream for which men would die willingly. It was another of the essential ingredients that she felt her son needed. People with a goal. Such people would be easy to imbue with fervor and fanaticism. They could be wielded like a sword to win back Paul's place for him." Mm-hmm. Okay, so I thought this was interesting because Jessica is sort of unknowingly going against Paul's wishes because Paul wants to avoid his terrible purpose at any cost. Like, he even last chapter, he changed his name to Muad'Dib Paul, right? Because he wanted to change it in any way. But then Jessica is just out here like, "Oh, Paul, you gotta win back the Atreides fame and title."
She's like, "Stick to the script."
Yeah,
exactly. So she's just sort of encouraging it to happen, and this is foreshadowed in the words "wielded like a sword." And you would usually use the sword to take someone else out, which I guess in this case they kind of need to take out the Harkonnens and maybe the Imperium too. And this sounds terrible because it looks like she's viewing humans as expendable tools rather than individuals.
But at the same time, the Bene Gesserit have their own purpose or their own agenda behind everything, so they do view humans as
the words she uses, fervor, fanaticism, these are the words we've been using to describe the jihad, right? So
exactly,
so it's kind of, you're right, you know, this is Paul's terrible purpose, and you know, Jessica, I'm not sure whether Jessica sees the full scope of, you know, the consequence of
the, is she embracing it?
I don't even know if she's embracing it. It's that she thinks it is a good purpose, but she doesn't see the consequences. She's, you know, looking at it from the perspective of, oh, these Fremen will be willing to die for Paul so that they can all benefit, and everybody will you know, get the benefits of having the entire planet covered in water, right? But she doesn't see what the consequences are, but like Paul does see. Yeah, so beyond that, once Paul has too much power and, you know, they'll be lining up behind the Atreides banner, right, to slaughter, and that's not... So now I can honestly kind of see why, you know, why Paul is thinking this way.
That's so much. Jessica just short-sighted.
Yeah, short-sighted, but yeah. So really, really interesting quote, yeah.
One thing I am curious about is that Jessica suspects that the dream's religious fervor resulted from Liet Kynes' influence. So obviously this dream isn't like unheard of on Arrakis, because I'm sure someone's obviously dreamed of, you know, a world of greenery and abundant water, but I'm guessing only until the arrival of Kynes, the Imperium planetary ecologist, were they able to like start making plans for this to happen, to like connect with the Fremen by making the choice to go native. He was able to like link up with them and truly balloon this like dream into a vision, onto this zealous radical state of it, what it is today.
Yeah.
In a certain way, Kynes is almost like a cult leader, having indoctrinated a lot of the Fremen into this religion, kind of. And my real question is that, did Kynes ever intend for this to kind of set up the Fremen to like benefit any particular party, like Jessica and Paul is going to use them now? Or was it just like unintentional, and like the effects of his dream can now be harnessed by other people just like unintentionally? I don't know.
Well, I don't think Kynes ever expected his dream to gain such a cult-like following.
Fair,
like, he expected to get supporters, yes, but he didn't think they would just be like, "Oh, you are the god of water now." But I also do believe that Jessica and Paul can use this dream to further their agenda, because if the Fremen truly believe that Paul will be the one to transform Arrakis, then they would stop at nothing to get what Paul wants.
I mean, again, it kind of devolves into this fanaticism, I feel like. It's just
which
cult-ish.
We want to avoid.
Yeah, which Paul wants to avoid. Jessica doesn't even see it. Yeah, which is, you know, the more Jessica pushes this idea, the further they go down this road, right? But it's really contradictory, and it's why Paul, you know, has all these terrible decisions to make. It's because, yes, he does want to accomplish Kynes' mission, I feel like. But, you know, accomplishing Kynes' mission, it's, you know, that's past the point of no return almost. Yeah, he has to keep going and keep going, and eventually he'll control the universe, which is not what he wants, right? Yeah, so it's really terrifying for him, I feel like.
Yeah.
So we have this kind of somber scene, this is actually kind of drawing allusions to Paul's vision back in chapter 3. But there's quite a few differences that I wanted to highlight here so that everybody can notice them. And for one, the setting is different. So in his vision, Paul can see sand and they're waiting for something or to meet some people. And Paul is really excited. While here, it's a totally different situation. It's just totally different. There's really not many parallels. He's not excited for anything there. He doesn't, you know, he's above ground. Right. And so, I mean, the second thing is in his vision, Chani says home world, but here she says birth world, if I recall correctly, or maybe the exact wording is wrong, but she said definitely said something different. And lastly, Paul, you know, recites her a poem in his vision, which is, you know, one of Gurney's poems for like sad times or something like that. But here Paul sings a love song. So although I'm not sure the exact significance of each difference between his vision and reality, I don't know whether each individual thing has a significance. But what I know is what is significant is that how the future can be changed. And even though parts of the future can remain constant, much of it is mutable, you know, with individual choices. So it's kind of this, again, fight between fate and free will, right? So so whether you have the capability to change your future, whether it's all predetermined Calvinist-like. So here, in this world, I do believe, you know, each decision, and we've seen a lot of examples of this, but each decision you make has a very large
kind of free will.
I think it's more free will than fate. You're not locked into anything.
And actually here we see Chani playing directly into this whole dream of his, and she's actually moving quite boldly in my opinion, and like without a lot of concern of what Jessica thinks about like her coming onto Paul like this. And like I'm not sure she's unintentionally doing all this like getting intimate with Paul, but she's definitely like asking him a lot about his home world and asking him to do a lot for her, and it's just a nice setup for a lot more intimate moments down the road. I think it's kind of cute.
Yeah, it is pretty.
Of course the love master knows all about it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, anyways,
God, let's sing the love song now.
Well, do you want to sing it or shall I?
Nah, you can take it.
Okay.
I mean, if you want.
Yeah, I'll take it. Even though I'm not the man most suited for the job. So here's the song that Paul sings for Chani. So I'll go ahead and read it, and perhaps I'll present a few comments. I don't, you know, not too high quality, but yeah. So here it goes. This clear time of seeing embers, the gold bright suns lost in first dusk. What frenzied senses, desperate musk, our consort of remembering. Night's pearl-censored requiem. Tis for us. What joys run then, bright in your eyes? What flower-spangled amours pull at our hearts? What flower-spangled amours fill our desires? Wow. So, yeah, I have to say it's really cool. It is rather vivid, and it is a love song. Honestly, you just read it and you can see, right? So, in the text itself, I can't really comprehend it. I'm sure there's some deeper meaning, but it reads more like a traditional love song. A few words here I wanted to point out just to define censer, which is a container to burn incense. Incense is this like fume, right? And requiem, which is a mass for the dead. So I don't know if y'all have heard Mozart's Requiem, which is one of his last compositions. I can't really recall, but it's really famous. So go ahead and check that out. I think it's an opera. And amor, which is love, you know, it's amor, but like a and then more, as in, you know, more people or more things.
Yeah,
it's not the normal amor spelling like in Spanish, amor, right?
So amor. Yeah.
So however, maybe it's French actually, but I'm not sure. However, clearly Paul is using some of his, you know, vocal or voice ability to induce some extra feeling in the words, right? And the text even implies
manipulative.
Yeah, I mean, the text even implies that Jessica is aroused, you know, to some physical or primitive desire, right? But the real question is, as Jessica says, why does my son sing a love song to that girl child? So Jessica kind of hints at it.
You kind of get it.
Yeah.
You can see what her views on Chani is.
Yeah. Girl child, you clearly sees her as immature and not worthy of the standing, right? And Jessica hints at it because, you know, she says that Paul's instincts might be true sometimes, but what instincts, right? Is this some, you know, premonition that Paul has or some foresight that coerces him to court Chani, right? Some, you know, some whisper from the future, just be like, yeah, you got to go after this girl, bro. Yeah. If you don't get this girl, you won't get any others. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but Paul just, yeah, just before you're out saving the world, this is your only time to date.
Paul and Chani shippers are going to have a field day over.
Yeah. I mean, I'm already shipping though, like, at this point, but
actually, I think it's quite interesting that Jessica calls her girl child when Chani used to call it Paul a man child.
Yeah, that's what I saw too. Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's weird, interesting.
Because in terms of qualifications, I think Chani is more fitted to the Fremen lifestyle.
Definitely.
Well, obviously, because she's been living that life
for a while. But Paul also knows their ways, though, right? So
yeah,
kind of naturally. So I mean, I don't know. Well, they're fit each other. Yeah, they fit each other. So. Yeah, but I mean, Paul just kind of comes up with this specific song out of nowhere, which doesn't match the tenseness of the situation at all, really. I mean, you don't sing a love song, kind of just, you know, more like Gurney's tone poem for sad times might be of more applicable or appropriate, right?
Yeah. I mean, that is pretty interesting, though. But also, knowing Paul, he probably isn't just going to settle for Chani.
Hey.
Yay. I'm just kidding. I mean, who knows, though? But on a more serious note, I wonder. I'm still kind of, I'm also pretty confused about why his instincts told him to sing a love song. Like, I know he's a teenage boy going through puberty, but there's gotta be something more to it.
Honestly,
I mean, no, perhaps by getting close to Chani, Paul can figure out the knowledge needed to change Arrakis. But that's just my best guess.
Maybe Chani is again somehow connected to his terrible purpose. I feel like everything is, you know, it's all strings, right, in the master plan. But don't know what kind of makes Paul, you know, go after Chani here, or Chani go after Paul. Really,
it's
honestly
all part of my master plan.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, like after finishing the book, I kind of searched it up. Like, what is Chani's clear role in this book? Because I know Chani in this book at least will be mostly like a side character, but according to Reddit, I never read the other books, but supposedly Chani gets more of a main spotlight in the other books following Dune, so I don't really know.
So not in the main three books, you said, or
no, like in this book at least, like in Dune art book, she's not like super important in this book, but she gets more spotlighted later on down the road, so I'm not sure if she adopts a bigger role in his life.
I mean, the three books are kind of important, though. They, as you know, one after the other, they are a full kind of series. So,
I mean, let us know if you guys want us to check out the other books after this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's their plan for now. But, so we're going to go for the other two. You know, like Children of Dune, and you know, and the other ones, right? So, but yeah. So right now, I mean, we got to get through this book first. Yeah, then we got to get through this chapter, right? Yeah.
So actually, we're actually getting to the very end of our chapter, and we ended off on two conflicting internal thoughts of both Jessica and Paul. So we see Jessica once again losing herself to her own fears of like the unfamiliar Fremen lifestyle, and like her fear that like anything could go wrong and they could just be like violently attacked or something, but also like her helplessness in helping Paul now, because he continues to step further and further into the Fremen society, which he also like knows nothing about, but at the same time he's doing it pretty well, like he's doing a pretty good job. And at the same time, Paul is kind of weirdly like hating his descent into the depths of his faintly familiar Fremen world and like his premonitions, right? But he's kind of blaming his mother for pushing him into this, which is like fair, but at the same time his mother saw it as like the best way to survive, so I don't really know like how much he can blame her, to be honest. But all he knows is that his lack of control over the direction of his life, his like fear of his visions, is really like the source of his melancholy. And it's just like, to me, it's just like a lot of teen angst going on inside Paul's head right now.
I love how you described it as teen angst.
Yeah, I thought it was funny too.
But honestly, the ending was so ominous. He called his own mother his enemy, and
I know,
that
she's like, whoa,
right? And then he also said that she brought him into the world and trained him just for the sole purpose of bringing the jihad. And that just sounds terrible. It's just like, oh, you're raising a genocidal man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's... I mean, Paul immediately jumps to the worst conclusion. I mean, we definitely need to see the context, right?
I mean, whether she's aware of what her actions mean or she doesn't, the relationship between Paul and Jessica looks like it's going to turn for the worse.
That's not good because they rely on each other, I feel like.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. They're only two outworlders here, otherworlders here, right? And mm-hmm. they need each other, though. So we can't have this.
We can't have this.
You know, I thought Jessica was going to be the mentor slash guide role, you know, to Paul.
Right, because we know that Paul's training is still isn't over.
Yeah, so I don't know, actually. Yeah. I mean, we did see earlier about how, you know, Jessica's bringing the jihad and how she's, you know, encouraging it and she doesn't have the foresight. But, you know, Paul, I don't know if he sees all of this. You know, he definitely can't read Jessica's mind, right? We can. So I don't know. It's really interesting, this dynamic. Yeah, I mean, we have to wait until
I don't like
chapters.
Where this is going.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I kind of liked it when Jessica's re-emerging into Paul's life after the whole, like, mm-hmm. I remember she was shocked from like getting thrown into the Doom world, and now she's like doing a pretty good job in his life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, it's a really weird note to end off the episode. But yeah, on that angsty note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read the words, "He wondered at the sudden chill in Fenring's voice," in chapter 35.
Whoa,
in
Fenring's
Dune,
back.
Yeah, Fenring's back. That's a name we haven't seen in a while. In Dune, in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at Do Not Enter, Reddit, use such Do Not Enter, Twitter at Do Not Enter, and email us at Do Not Enter at gmail.com. That is DUNENOTENTER at gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or I dare say.
Nolan, your turn.
Yeah, it's definitely Nolan's turn.
Correctons.
Okay.
You croutons.
Croutons. Yeah, now I'm hungry. Great. Thank you very much. Yeah, so. Please give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time. Just go and make an account. And, of course, go to our podcast and click the 5-star button because it's the only one that exists. I mean, mm-hmm. So you got to click that one, right?
Yep.
But on a real note, it does serves two purposes. One, on a personal note, it lets us know that we're doing a good job and motivates us to keep creating content for you guys, and also helps us climb the charts to get Dune and our podcast to a wider variety of listeners. So yeah, we would really appreciate that. Go ahead and do that if you want to and you actually feel that we're doing a good job. Otherwise, have a great week and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.